Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to the Paychecks and Balances podcast, where we have fun. Yes, fun. Chopping it up about work and money for millennials.
And today's episode is executive produced by PNB patrons Michael Minix and Morayo S. If you'd like to learn more about becoming a PNB patron, visit paychecksandbalances.com/patron. Or if you're a drinker, it's spelled like Patron.
There it is. Also, don't forget to complete the first ever Paychecks and Balances audience survey. This is your chance to tell us who you are so we can help you where you are. To complete it, visit paychecksandbalances.com/survey. Again, paychecksandbalances.com/survey. Yo, I feel like that car salesman with like the balloon thing that's like flopping in the wind. But anyway, you know, this is your chance to give us feedback. And, you know, it won't affect the country, but it will affect the show.
You know, speaking of which, I do feel like if you work at Patron, I'm sure there's three different ways to pronounce it. We might just go ahead and take on the marketing for that. So it can be paychecksandbalances.com/Patron if you'd like to sponsor that part of the show. Just putting that out there, speaking it to the universe. Join us also on our social medias at PayBalances on Twitter, Instagram, and yes, folks, Pinterest. We don't have much there yet, but we do like to put and pin cute and colorful things. I think they will be rolling out soon. Follow us because that will change.
Big things popping, bro. I mean, we do got all the social medias covered, a lot planned for 2017. The survey is also a part of that. There's places that people said that we should be. So we're trying to get there, build with y'all. But anyway, I'm going to let you introduce today's guest.
Yeah, I won't detract too much. I'm going to need a lessons learned on Pinterest. But today we're joined by Wilson Muskinen, Wilson, founder of TheMoneySpeakEasy.com, which will be in the show notes. I had to emphasize the, like the comedians whose names I just forgot right there in the Keenan Peele.
Keenan Peele, I think.
Where he discusses views on taboo personal topics such as debt, budgeting, saving, and investing, and helping young professionals reach their financial goals, which should sound familiar to y'all because that's what we're doing here. Thanks for joining us, Wilson.
Thank you very much for having me.
So beyond what I hit there, of course, tell the good people a little about yourself.
Yeah, about me, a little bit of background. I'm originally from Chicago, born and raised, grew up in a suburb about 20 miles south of Chicago. So I definitely grew up during the Michael Jordan Bulls era.
Boo.
So we were winning championships every year. So yeah, hate all you want.
Knicks fan.
Oh, you got a Knicks fan in here? Oh, good. My wife's a Knicks fan. I grew up in New York. She's a Knicks fan. So, but my family, I'm actually first generation American. My family grew up in Haiti and immigrated. But obviously I was born and raised in the States, and my dad's a physician. So you can imagine my dad actually came over here and he did his like residency and did his medical exams. I think English is his third or maybe fourth language. So he was pretty badass. My dad's been my role model for my entire life. But the reason I brought up my father is because that's where I learned about personal finance. And so when I was growing up, in order to get my allowance, I had to read books and write book reports on the books that he gave me.
Wait, but what?
Yeah.
No, that's like the ultimate intellectual swindle.
Exactly. So instead of doing like, well, I had to do chores, but like to get my real allowance, I had to read books. But I wasn't reading like, you know, Goosebumps or Nancy Drew or Judy Blume, right? Like
Goosebumps.
My dad was having me read like Robert Kiyosaki, like Peter Lynch, Dale Carnegie, Napoleon Hill, right? And so I was writing book reports on these books, right? And so, but I don't think he considered, or like I really ate up those books. So I really started to like them. And I was reading them whether I was getting allowance or not. So I really started to eat that stuff up. So much so, like, I had no interest in pursuing medicine. So I didn't do that. So anyway, I went to school. I got a business degree undergrad. I went to a small school in central Illinois called Illinois Wesleyan University. And for those folks that aren't from Chicago, Illinois as a state, Chicago's at the very northeastern tip. And basically anything south of the Chicago, the south suburbs, is basically considered southern Illinois. So like, and so, so my friends would say like you went to school in Kentucky, basically. And went to school there, but college for me was when I first realized that people didn't learn the basics of personal finance, right? So like, you don't know what you don't know. Right. And so that's when I started seeing people like stand in line at the cafeteria to get credit cards for t-shirts.
Bruh,
yeah. You remember that? And I started, I saw people like buying like pizza and gas and stuff like that and clothes with credit cards. And I knew that they didn't have like not even a part-time job. And so like you start to see things and you're like, that's weird. Like, why would you do that? Like, and so those things started to come up for me. So for me, like after I finished undergrad, I wanted to go be a personal financial advisor. Like I was like, man, people don't know. Like people are doing these crazy things with their money and they don't know. And
well, let me jump in there. What most surprised you? Like, okay, so people don't know about debt. They might not know about investing. They might not just know about money in general. What surprised you the most?
In terms of surprised me the most is that, like, for me, the idea that a company would give you a credit card with no verification of any sort of employment or imagine this. So a credit card is basically a plastic loan, right? It's a loan on plastic. And so Imagine you as the person giving the loan, right? Imagine giving somebody $1,000 without even checking to see if they could pay you back. Right. And so like that to me,
I would never do that anywhere in life.
Exactly. And so but it was happening all over the place. And I'm like, this is complete insanity. Like, what is going on? And recently, you know, they passed laws that change that. So you don't see the credit card companies at cafeterias anymore. I think you have to verify some sort of income now. But a law had to be passed to change that. So, you know, that was one of the things where I was like, this is crazy. People are spending like crazy. And I'll give you the example that it goes back for me. So I did have a credit card in college, but the credit card bill went straight to my parents. Right. And so, again, my parents are immigrants. So, like, if they saw like Jimmy John's or Papa John's on their credit card statement, they'd be like, who the hell is this John's family and why are they taking money out of my pocket? Right. And so, like, there was no way that I was going to use a credit card to spend things on things that I wouldn't have to explain to my parents later. So it was amazing to me to watch people spend that kind of money on stuff and not even know how they were going to pay it back.
So I want to explore that a little bit because it's something that I can't speak to and I'm not even sure that I can wholly relate to, but I know a lot of our listeners are first generation. So how do you think that shaped or did it your childhood and especially maybe your view compared to your peers or people maybe even your age?
So partly I think there's sort of the immigrant experience of our parents making the sacrifice to come here. And so they had a lot riding on them. They left everything that they knew to come over here to make it. And so, you know, clearly, you know, education is stressed, all these kinds of things, but they had no choice but to make it. And, you know, this being the land of opportunity, this kind of thing, I think there are pressures for you to get the umpteenth degree and that kind of thing. But I do think that there are still some misconceptions there. So like, for example, within different immigrant communities, that first generation kid, they're supposed to get, you know, the PhD in whatever they do. But because the cost of higher education kept completely rising, the general consensus was it doesn't matter how much it costs, just get into the best school that you can get into and worry about it later. Well, now people are finding that, you know, they have an art history degree with, you know, $100,000 in debt and they have, you know, a $40,000 job. And so, you know, I'm a math geek and that math does not add up. And so that's part of the challenge that people are finding out now and what we need to sort of discuss and talk about. And that's one of the reasons for the site is that in Money Speakeasy in general, speakeasies were, if you're familiar with speakeasies, there were these bars in the 1920s that were secret bars because the government had banned all alcohol, even like beer and wine.
Oh, so like prohibition bars, basically.
Exactly. So if you've seen Boardwalk Empire, you're familiar with that. And so I feel like talking about money is very taboo. So I'm trying to create a community, particularly of young professionals that want to talk about and address some of these financial issues. And so that's really what I'm trying to get across and really what I'm really trying to talk about.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about the website. And I want to set the stage. I just realized we did not talk about how we met. So we met Wilson at FinCon 2016, which we definitely plugged on the show. Great experience. We made a lot of great contacts. And we just had, 2-hour conversation about, you know, investing, finances, money. And we just knew that we had to have this man on the show. So as I hope y'all are getting from this takeaway, these are some of these great topics that we talked about there. We want to share with y'all.
Also, the value of going to conferences, you make good connects and you take those friendships and those relationships with you and boom, you get a podcast episode.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And that's why I had to set the stage because our first topic, it's not the nicest, but I think it needs to be talked about. And that's the uphill battle that millennials face. And I shared an article with you before this show and that Mashable actually covered, which I thought was a little bit weird. But the title was Millennials Need to Save 22% of Their Income
Yeah.
I don't know where they're coming up. I know where they're coming up with that number. I don't know where they think we're going to find 22% more of the money that we're already not saving. But from the article, it says a number of analysts predict the continuing pattern of slower growth, familiar, has taken hold since the Great Recession, could cause stock market returns to fall from 7% the annual average since 1950 to a possible 5% in the decades to come. That would be us, if you're wondering who the decades to come are going to impact.
Yeah.
So do you have any thoughts on that? Or is that something that you can relate to or that you're seeing?
Absolutely. I don't want to speak to the numbers and the trajectories, but what I will speak to is that we have some pretty huge challenges. Millennials, when I say we, I'm talking millennials, and I'm on the older end. I think we're about the same age. So we're on the older end of the millennial spectrum. I think it's age 18 to 35. But so we're on the older end of the millennials, but millennials are facing these huge headwinds that, because, you know, I'll go back again, that we're not talking about finances. We need to think about how we're going to deal with these huge headwinds. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So number one, personal finance isn't taught in schools, right? So the basics, when I say personal finance, I'm talking about the basics of budgeting, saving, managing debt, and investing. Those aren't taught in schools. And so we're all in the dark about a lot of these topics. Obviously, your podcast is trying to break that. And many of us are trying to have these kinds of conversations. I think the second thing, major headwind that we have in our way, is that companies are getting more in terms of productivity, but they're actually providing less to employees. Mm. And I think we have to be very clear. I think people have personal feelings about corporate America and that kind of thing. But companies in and of themselves, businesses, are designed to generate profit for shareholders, period, full stop. That is what they're designed to do. It's like an animal in the wild. If you if you threaten an animal in the wild, its basic DNA is about survival. It will kill you. Like, and so that is what it's designed to do. That's what its DNA is. So that's what the businesses are not designed to take care of us. They're not designed to provide us with retirement. That's not the mission statement. I don't care what the mission statement says. Companies, their general purpose are designed to generate profits for shareholders. That's what they're supposed to do. So we have a lot of talk about, you know, globalization, offshoring jobs. But in our mind, we love technology, but technology is probably killing many more jobs than outsourcing or offshoring is doing.
Yeah.
And we've got to be prepared in thinking about that. So I was thinking about this the other day. You think about malls. Personally, I couldn't tell you the last time I went to a mall.
Yo, I have to jump in with NPR was saying that malls might go away. They're talking about this year was the lowest returns that malls were seeing across the land. They were saying that basically you made a bad bet if you built the mall in the last 10 years, because this was like the slowest Black Friday on record or something.
Was it?
As far as people physically going to brick and mortar stores. Huh. Like they said, online, you know, returns are up, you know, 125%. But also, I mean, just think about it. How many crazy Black Friday videos did you see this year?
Yeah.
And think about all the ones you saw years before.
I saw like one of Kohl's and that was it pretty much.
Yeah. People aren't going to the store.
They're disappearing. It's not necessary. I can't tell you the last time I went to a mall. Like the last time I said to myself, I'm going to go shopping. Let me head to the mall. Like, no, like it just does not happen. Right. It'd take me 5 seconds to find what I need on my phone.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I'm usually like, man, I'm gonna go shopping and I'd head to the couch.
Yo.
And do three other things.
It's funny because I literally went to the mall last night, but it was not my choice.
Ooh.
If it was up to me, I would have just ordered right off of online. Choo-choo. You know, happy wife, happy life. So.
Exactly. Exactly. And
that's the only weekend, man.
Exactly. So malls, you think about waitresses. Now I'm starting to see iPad kiosk at restaurants. You think about fast food, drivers, whether it's cabs, Uber's doing testing out the automated drivers now. They're going to get rid of them. You think about toll booths, you know, like remember those jobs that a lot of us had in high school and maybe even during college that we're working part time. So technology is first eliminating those low wage jobs. But my point is that technology also, if you think about what technology does well, what computers do really well, computers do repetitive tasks very well, right? So you give it a simple task and it can do it repetitively very efficiently. So they came first for the low-wage jobs, but computers are getting much more advanced and now they're starting to do even more complex tasks even better than humans are doing. So like they're coming for data analysts, stockbrokers. So I'll give you an example. You remember the movie Trading Places with Eddie Murphy?
Oh, I was taking a face off. I'm completely off base. I'm gonna let you cook though.
No. The movie trading places, well, you know, on the floor of the stock market exchange, you know, the stockbrokers that are holding up the flags and to trade stocks, those guys that are on the floor of the stock exchange.
Yeah.
If you go to the New York Stock Exchange now, I was there about a year or so ago. There's like 10 people in there and there's like 500 computer screens.
Wow.
And so there's no physical person that is trading the stock. So when you go and buy a stock, there's no physical person that's running up there for you to say, buy this stock. And like, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's the exact image I have in my head. I'm sitting here seeing people screaming, waving pieces of paper. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess.
Right. You just ruined my fantasy of the stock market exchange, number one. And then where are they getting these stock photos? Because every time you read a news article, it's always like investments are up and it's a picture of a happy guy. And then when investments are down, he's always frowning. But I guess that picture has gotten less crowded over the years. It used to be like 100 people. Now it's like one.
Yeah, and they had those like special jackets, so you knew like what company they were from, and they waved. No, they're gone. Anyway, point is that computers are getting better, and they're coming for those middle income jobs as well. And so the overall point is that we've got to talk about these kinds of things because as millennials, we're coming up and during this era, and we've got to prepare ourselves. Technology is a challenge, but it's also an opportunity, and so we've got to think about. Okay, we've got to think about different ways that we can prepare ourselves that our company's purpose isn't to take care of us for our whole lives. We've got to think about other ways to diversify our income and do different things in order to hit those numbers that you were referencing before in terms of saving. We've got to have a completely different view about saving versus spending than our parents did, than Gen X or the boomer generation did, because the Gen Xers came up during the rise of credit cards. Credit cards came into being around the 70s. Like they really hit their popularity around the 70s. Before that, if you didn't have the cash, you weren't buying it. And so now you have our generation that grew up with credit cards as a normal thing, but incomes did not rise with inflation, right? And so we've got a lot less money to deal with, but we're still spending like our parents did. And we can't do that. We can't afford to do it. That's some of the conversations that we need to start having.
I really like what you said that, I never looked at it this way, that a credit card is a plastic loan. That's going right in the show notes. And I want to pull also from the article so it's not all doom and gloom, even though I'm still mentally grieving over here. I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to make it through the show now that my stock market fantasy is all messed up. Like, I'm really messed up right now trying to envision not being hundreds of people running around at the stock market or something. That being said, so the tips from the article, they had three. To start saving, which doesn't sound very surprising, but it was literally tip number one. But I think the point was earlier and longer. And I read another piece and it kind of stuck out to me that I think this might be the first generation where we'll be taking mid-career retirements and maybe not officially retire. And they said that essentially you're breaking up like stop gaps where you're trying to, because millennials want to prioritize time, which actually you cannot get back. So you take, in your 30s, it was an interesting article, but it's kind of a privilege or a luxury to say, well, I'm going to take a part-time job so I can travel. But, you know, if you invest and save and have your purpose and your vision, your priorities, we talk about on the show set correctly, I could see it happening. But I do think the career arc, linear, chronological career that everyone has been doing up until this point is going to are going to have to change or evolve. And the second tip was to take advantage of tax benefits and employer matches. And then the third was don't stash your retirement money in a savings account. So,
or a mattress.
Right. Any of those stick out to you or that you want to expand upon?
Absolutely. On my website, themoneyspeakeasy.com, I have a guide that talks about maximizing your employee benefits. And one of the reasons that we put that together was that people are leaving thousands of dollars on the table in employee benefits. You know, I was talking about earlier about companies, giving less, but now you have to go out and get your benefits. So you remember when you started with the company, HR handed you this booklet and said, go forth and do well. And that employee benefits packet kind of got into your drawer and you just got into other things. You might have set up stuff, but like you haven't really thought about it since you started. Within that packet is a lot of goodies and a lot of things in terms of taking advantage of your retirement benefits, your insurance, your healthcare insurance, life insurance. You need to know what disability insurance is. So a lot of these benefits are things that your company is either paying for or helps subsidize, which actually increases your overall income that we're not taking advantage of. So we really need to go back and take a look at that and really need to, in order to boost our income. In terms of retirement savings, let me put it this way. Let's say we did have a 40-year career from age 25 to 65, a 40-year career. They've projected out if you get a college degree, the average, so if we averaged out our salary over 50 years, you're going to make about $2.5 million of income. So the average person that has a college degree, $50,000 a year average over their career for 40 years, $2.5 million. But in order to live that lifestyle, because of inflation, if your users know inflation, basically the rising cost of goods, right? It, something that costs, you know, like gas used to cost like 99 cents back in the day.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, you remember? So things get more expensive over time. And so your dollar is less valuable tomorrow than it is today. And so with that $2.5 million that you're making, in order to live the way that you live now or live comfortably, you're probably going to need upwards of $5 million 40 years from now. And so you've got to take your $2.5 million that you make over a 40-year career and somehow make $5 million out of that. And keep in mind, you still got to live. You still got to live and eat.
Yeah.
And so that's where that 20% number comes from, is because if the percentage that that money is growing is smaller, it means you need to put away more in order to hit that number. I'm not saying the number is 5 million for everybody. I'm just giving an example, but that's essentially the game, is that you've got to get to a point where your assets, you're taking your income and you're generating enough from whether it's investing. And that's why the saving in a regular savings account is not going to do it. If you're only making $2.5 million over the 40 years, like, you're not going to be able to turn that into $5 million.
Yeah, no, not at 0.004 interest rate.
Exactly. Exactly. So I try to break that down simply for people in terms of why it's important to invest, and important to invest early is because that's what you're going to need. If you're going to say, I'm going to retire, meaning you're going to stop generating income, you're going to need to live off your investments and your investment income. And in order to do that, to generate that type of income with inflation, that means stuff is going to be more expensive 40 years from now than it is today. That's what you're going to need to accomplish. And so that's why we need to have these conversations earlier than later.
You know, I'm glad that you said that, because I know a lot of people out there, and I've been this person more years into my 20s and possibly into my 30s. I will neither confirm nor deny, where I was like, you know what? I need this money today. Like, I can save for retirement later. I got these bills today I want to take care of. I got these dreams today I want to pursue. And there are people who, they've actually debated with us about the value of starting to put money away for retirement. And I love what you said, because it's like, yo, if you want to make it harder for yourself later on, then go ahead, keep delaying on saving. But if you want to make this easier for yourself later on, the time is now to get started, not waiting until you're 30 or 35 or 40 to finally start putting money away.
Yeah, I basically, the analogy that I have for it is basically your income are like seeds, right? And basically investing and growing your money is the water that you're putting on the seeds. And compound interest is the sunlight that makes it grow. So either you're not putting down enough seeds, you're not putting enough money in there, or you're not investing, you're not watering it. And if you're not watering it, it doesn't matter how much water you put on it. If it's not getting compound interest, it's not getting that sunlight, it's not going to grow. And so most people's, in terms of their finances, they had to deal with one of those three issues, whether they're dealing with having enough seeds, whether they're investing the right way and putting the water on it, or whether they have the sunlight of compound interest in order to make it grow.
Got it.
Yo, that was an excellent analogy, by the way. I was over here writing it down. That's why I was quiet. So the website, I think we spoke about it a little bit, but just in case, it was themoneyspeakeasy.com, and we'll talk about that, and I'll have that in the show notes as well. So far, what has been, I know you did a revamp, so what was your most popular post? What is the content that is driving people?
Yeah, so I had a couple of posts on there that people liked. One was talking about financial infidelity within relationships. So, and I shared, my wife actually wrote a part two of that post where she shared about how our relationship almost ended because of financial infidelity. And when I say financial infidelity, that means when you're
I gotta hit a record scratch. So did she know about the first post? Because I'm trying to think, if I wrote a financial infidelity post, I'd have to have all kinds of disclaimers and pre-conversations with future bae. And probably a few ex-bays. So how did that conversation go?
So with financial infidelity, so part one was just, what is financial infidelity and how does it affect relationships? Part two was, here's my wife's story about how financial infidelity almost ended our relationship. And so there are two parts there. I'll leave you with sort of that cliffhanger. But in terms of the conversation, unless you're transparent about your finances, and this is one of the things about finances, and one of the things I say often, finances are taboo. So let's stop for a second and think about your three closest friends. Your three closest friends, I'm willing to guess that you know more about their sex lives than you do about how much money they make or what their financial goals are.
Yes.
Right? Like, if we step back for a second, that's a little weird, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
unless they're married. I have noticed with like the married folks, it's not like, yeah, it was the wife last night. Well, that's probably the, that's like an awful way to put it. I certainly did not mean that, but yeah.
Making love to the spouse.
Yeah, there we go.
But you get the overall point is that, we're not talking about even our goals. So let's say you had a goal. Let's say you were in some debt, whether it's credit card debt or student loan debt, and you were really trying to pay that off and pay that down. But you're not communicating that with your friends. And so all of a sudden, like, your friends are inviting you out and you're not going out. And so there's all this kind of like unsaid, unspoken deal. Like, your friends are supposed to be the ones that are supporting you for your goals. So if you have a financial goal of, you know, reducing your expenses, you should be able to communicate that with the people closest to you and say, hey, instead of hitting the bar or hitting the club, like, you know, let's hit up this museum, or let's, you know, there's this free event going on over here. Let's do that. Let's do something instead. Or you have that awkward conversation at the restaurant at the end of the restaurant. Well, I just paid for this appetizer, or I only had drinks. And like, how are we going to split the bill? So I think we need to be able to talk about what our financial goals are. At least I'm not saying that everybody needs to know like your balance sheet and your income statement. I'm saying that we need to be able to talk candidly about what our financial goals are, because at the end of the day, we all support each other. And so, you know, if all your listeners are broke, then, you know, that Patreon page isn't getting funded. So, like, we need to be able to support each other. And the better we are with our finances as a community, the more that we can support each other in our side hustles and our businesses. And so we depend on each other to do financially well.
Definitely, man.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, well done.
If you're like me, you probably hate grocery shopping. And if you're like me, you probably hate figuring out dinner every night. And that's where HelloFresh comes into play. So HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novice chefs like myself to seasoned home cooks. And one of the best things about this is if you're cooking just for yourself, each meal could last you 2 days. I discovered that when I was making this sizzling beef stir fry last week. I promise you, it really was sizzling. And if you're wondering how the food gets delivered, it arrives at your doorstep in a special insulated box for free, 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 free. So for $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks. Again, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks when you subscribe. Check it out.
Also on the site, I saw you had two posts about credit. So what you need to know about credit, part one and two. There's a couple things that I wanted to pull from there, but is kind of as an opening, is there anything that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, what I wanted to bring to that post particularly was some of the misconceptions about credit. You know, for example, that you had to have a credit card to build your credit. Like, you know, things like that, that I wanted to make sure that weren't part of the current dialogue with personal finance, because we don't talk about it a lot of misconceptions stay out there and live on. And so those are the things that I wanted to sort of, you know, myth bust.
Yeah. And the quote that I pulled from the article, and we'll have this in the show notes, folks, so we're probably not going to go too detailed here, but credit scores neither take income nor savings into account, and credit scores are not a complete measure of how well you're doing financially. Many refer to the credit score as a debt management score because it simply measures how well you borrowed and pay back money. I had not considered it that way. First of all, especially lately, I think because of all the issues that came up with repayment, I didn't realize that how little or apparently a non-factor income was, since they always ask you about your income. I always saw the two as related, but it seems here that there's a mutually exclusive relationship.
I mean, that's probably for the better for most of us, because if you think about how irresponsible some people are with credit cards, or they log into Mint and like your net worth is like negative 250,000, it's probably better that they don't factor that in.
Well, let me make a distinction between your assets, like how much you owe and how much you own, your assets and your liabilities, and your income, how much you make every year, your salary, how much you make every year. So let me make that distinction first. Neither of those, whether it's your assets, your net worth, or your income, are factors in your credit score. So whether you make $1 million a year or $15,000 a year, you could have the same credit score. Those are not factors in what your credit is. So when people, you know, talk about, well, I got good credit, like that doesn't mean that you have that has nothing to do with how much you make or your net worth. Those are completely different topics. And so, again, these are sort of misconceptions that are in the ethos, if you will, that we don't understand. So all the credit score is saying is it's basically a grade. It all is saying is that you borrowed from these individuals and we're developing a score that says, how did you pay it back on time? How long have you had debt for and credit for? Are you good on that? And so that's all it's measuring. It's not measuring how much you make. It's not measuring your net worth. That's all it's measuring.
Right.
And there's a point by point breakdown on the website, folks, but I'll hit the top five, or I'll hit the five. That's payment history, amounts owed, credit utilized, length of credit history, new credit, and your credit mix. And then you can go to the website, which will be in the show notes for the details of those areas. Yep.
There it is. There it is. Now, Wilson, you also mentioned a couple of areas in your, so you call it an ebook or a digital guide, same thing to you, give yourself a raise.
Yeah, I just call it give yourself a raise. It's just employee benefits guide. Yep.
Got it. So in there, you talk about two things that I don't hear a lot about in these money conversations, and especially with younger people. And that's this idea of life insurance and also disability insurance. Can you talk a little bit about how people may be leaving money on the table there, and you know, why people may not feel as inclined to talk about these insurances as they are about the income side of things?
Yeah, so let's talk about life insurance first. With some companies, they'll actually pay for life insurance for their employees, right? And so what life insurance does essentially is if you pass away, the insurance company, insurance in general is basically just a bet. You're financially betting on unexpected events happening. And so you are paying money to an insurance company to say, hey, if I die, my income, my salary is no longer going to be there for myself or my family, my heirs. And so I'm going to need to replace that income for them so that they have money if I should suddenly pass away, because I can no longer provide that income. So that's what life insurance does. But not everybody needs to go out and get a ton of insurance, especially if you're single. You might say to yourself, well, if I'm single and I don't have children, well, then why do I need life insurance? Well, if you don't have life insurance, like somebody else is going to have to pay to bury you.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody's going to have to pay for that funeral. So to me, it's financially irresponsible to have somebody else, not that it's your fault that you passed away, but you know that you could take it. You know that we're mortal and you know that this can happen. So why not financially prepare for something like that? And these are what I'm talking about is low cost. Within your benefits, the company might pay for it in whole, right? So it's not even something that you might have to pay extra for. But you can at least go in and see what that benefit is. Funeral costs range, I think, from about $7,000 to $10,000. So it's not like you need a lot of life insurance if you're single and don't have children. But if you are married, you know, that income that you are generating, that you would be generating to pay for all kinds of things, is going to be gone. So you need to think about, you can purchase additional life insurance outside of your employer, but at least you should know that whether or not your employer is providing or you can pay for life insurance, because it's really cheap through your employer. It'll be a small amount of coverage, but at least it'll cover something like funeral costs if you should pass away. So you should be aware, at least if you have it or if you can purchase more. One more note on life insurance is that oftentimes if you purchase life insurance, you might have to take some sort of health exam.
Yeah.
Right. So like the company wants to know, you know, if you have terminally ill cancer, like they're going to have to pay out. So they need to know these things in advance. But with your employer, oftentimes, so if somebody is sick or does have health issues, it'll cost more. But sometimes you can purchase additional insurance through your employer and not have to go through those sort of health screening and tests. So people that are in that situation can increase their life insurance coverage through their employer, as opposed to going outside to purchase insurance. But that's an example of something on the life insurance side.
Now,
nice.
One thing I've also found is a lot of people don't think about the fact that life insurance effectively ends if they leave their company. You know, so
absolutely.
So you mentioned that idea. And of course, you know, we're not going to get into advising people with which life insurance companies to look at. But that's something to keep in mind, where if someone's thinking about going at it on their own, leaving their job, situation changes, that life insurance policy, as soon as you leave your employer, is suddenly not there anymore. And so I've actually been thinking myself about purchasing a life insurance policy. And I'm sure if there's a listener who sells life insurance, I'm probably going to now get an email about that. Well, actually, I've got six plans for you right here. But that's something for people to keep in mind. And I think sometimes people even struggle with that, you know, that's another monthly cost, which I know when people see something that's a recurring monthly cost and they don't think that it's something that's likely to happen, they feel less inclined to purchase it, even though they know what it's for. So do you have any words for those people who are kind of like, my company covers it, and even if my company didn't cover it, I think I'd be good? Anything you would say to those people?
Yeah, again, and this goes back to what we're talking about with companies. It's not a company's responsibility to take care of you or your family. And they can decide tomorrow that they don't need your services. And so it's incumbent upon you to take responsibility for yourself and your family. And so for the life insurance that you purchase or get outside, there's resources in the guide to help you think about that kind of thing. But think about the fact that you are responsible for the financial health of yourself and your family around you. And you don't want to leave that burden to others. You know, if you resign on Monday and something happens to you on Tuesday, the insurance company will not pay for it. I guarantee you. And so that's something that you need to consider. You can purchase policies. They're very cheap. Like, I'm talking like a lot of coverage for, you know, less than your cell phone bill. I'm talking like $20, $30 a month, something like that, to get a good amount of life insurance coverage. And so it's not something that's super expensive, but it's definitely something that you want to think about in terms of, hey, if I pass away tomorrow and, you know, I don't have a lot in my retirement account, right? What are the people around me, what is my family are going to do with my assets? And so what are they going to do financially going forward? And so we need to start having these conversations, start thinking about these kinds of things, because ish happens.
Yeah.
And so we need to be on top of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's serious. If you talk to anybody that has lost somebody close in the family that didn't have their finances together, it's real. And it's a real issue. So we need to take care of our business up front. It's not the sexy thing to do. It's not, you know, like, I'm sorry that it's not a sexy conversation that, you know,
it is morbid.
I can entice you about, you know, taking care of life insurance. It's not a sexy topic, but it's important. And we got to take care of the things that are important to take care of our families.
Definitely. And then the other side of that that I want to get your thoughts on is on disability insurance. Now, this is something that I know is often covered on some level by the employer, depending how their benefits packages are set up. Can you talk a little bit about the disability side of things?
Yeah. So what happens with disability, and a lot of people actually don't even know what it is or how it works. So when you have health insurance, for example, health insurance covers the expenses from the medical provider, right? So for example, some people are familiar with workers' compensation insurance, right? So if you get hurt on the job will provide some of the cost, not only to pay for the health insurance, but to pay you your income while you're out on workers' comp, right? But if you're hurt for some reason, you're injured and you're not on the job, it's not related to your work. And so this is where disability comes in. So health insurance takes care of the medical expenses, but your employer is not obligated to pay you or your salary if you're not showing up at the office, mm-hmm. right? And so disability says, disability insurance is about, okay, well, if I'm out, if I have a back injury, if I have cancer, for example, I still got to pay rent. I've still got to pay our mortgage. I still got to get food. I still got a car note to pay. I still got student loans. So a disability insurance is insuring your income if you're disabled. And it's so it would pay a percentage of your salary, percentage of your income while you're out on disability. So there's short-term disability, which pays for, I think, up to 3 months, if you're out up to 3 months, and then long-term disability after that. So for those that have had children, your spouse would be out on short-term disability during pregnancy,
yep.
right? And so like, so the income is gone during that period while they're out. And so you could get short-term disability during that time while you're having. So that's an example of short-term disability. Long-term disability, you know, like I use the example of cancer, for example. You're out, you're not in the office, you're not receiving your paycheck. They might not fire you, but they don't have to pay you. And so disability insurance would cover that. So oftentimes employers will offer disability insurance, but you should just know what the rules are up front So should that occur, at least you have some sort of understanding of how it's going to work. And a lot of disability covers probably about 60% often. So can you live if you're not working, if you're not able to work, can you live on 60% of your income? So that's what the policy covers, and that's what it's intended to do.
And I'm glad you mentioned that part, because there are some companies that will, and I'd say that these companies are far fewer than the ones who have a standard policy, but there are some companies that will try to make you whole if you go out on short-term disability. So for example, I worked someplace in the past where when women went out on maternity leave, they would get a certain number of weeks of their salary in addition to a short-term disability benefit. So it wasn't like they were getting 160% of income. It was kind of like, okay, if short-term disability covers 60% of income, we're going to fill in the additional 40% a month or 2 months. So that's a benefit that people probably don't even, you know, necessarily think about when they're, you know, maybe negotiating with a company or considering a new role. But that's also something to look into if you have family planning in mind. And one thing I would also mention here, and, you know, I'd always seen the, disability coverage on my insurance, but it wasn't real till my brother had an incident where, you know, he lost his leg and now he's essentially on disability right now. And just imagining if he didn't have some of that coverage there, and imagining if, you know, he wasn't in a situation where there were people who were helping out to be able to fill in some of those gaps. You know, it's really important that people kind of look at these things and go, what's available to me? And if it is 60%, what am I going to do to cover that other 40% in the case that something does happen to me? Because it's something that could happen to anyone.
Yeah. And also a note to your listeners as well that, you know, when we strike out on our own, if we so choose, you know, a lot of people are talking about, well, if you're not, you know, if you're not passionate about your job, leave. Okay, well, pump the brakes, understand what it is that you have in totality. I'm not saying don't leave your employer, but you need to understand some of these benefits that you have, because if you do leave your employer and strike out on your own, some of these things, you know, these leave, just like we were given the example of life insurance, these end when you end your relationship with your employer. And so, you know, if you're a sole proprietor, you're self-employed, you should really consider purchasing disability insurance, because nobody's going to pay you. There is no, you know, safety net there. If you're self-employed and you have a back injury, or you have, you know, like your brother with the leg injury. So these are things that you need to consider when you do go out on your own. Again, I'm not discouraging people to go out on their own. What I'm saying is understand the total compensation package, not just the salary, but the total compensation package, and make sure that you understand some of the ins and outs of this. So talk to your HR representative, pull out that HR manual that's at the bottom of your desk drawer, and, you know, make sure that you understand what benefits that you actually have, so that if and when you do decide to leave your employer, at least you know what you need to replace and what you need to cover.
There it is.
And to give people a number to work with if they want to start crunching that right now, I've seen it as low. It's 25% as far as the total compensation package. I've seen it as high as 33%. So it's not something that you're easily going to be able to walk away from, especially just taking into consideration, I think, what we're trying to not discourage folks, but to have an earnest conversation with yourself or whomever you may be going to work for, that that's on top of the salary you have right now. So if you don't have a business model and you're living paycheck to paycheck right now that cannot only replace your salary, but then put 25% on top of it, you might want to have a follow-up conversation.
Yeah.
In terms of the site, one of the things that I like to say is that the goal is not to prevent people from making bad financial decisions. That's not the goal. People are going to make bad financial decisions regardless. What I don't like is people making uninformed bad financial decisions. And that's where I really think that we need to dig into and talk about. If you want to take a risk on yourself, that's great. Do that. I encourage people taking a risk and betting on themselves. But that needs to be an informed decision, not an uninformed decision.
Like,
I know. Heart button. So the other thing, and it ties to what we're talking about here. So within the digital guide, you mentioned these additional perks and benefits people often forget to think about. And we're talking about some of those things now. So what do you think are some of the things that our professional friends out there forget to take advantage of most at their current company or when they're switching company? Like, are there things you find outside of what we've already talked about that people commonly overlook that could potentially be saving them money?
one of the big things, and I might divert a little bit, but let me cover wellness programs first. I think with wellness programs, so keep in mind, as far as your healthcare cost, your health insurance costs are concerned, I don't think people realize that, and you know, it's different for different companies, but companies are typically paying about, I think it's about 70% of the cost of your healthcare, and you're paying about 30%. Right. And that's why, you know, if you leave your company, if you've ever heard of like COBRA benefits, like then all of a sudden, like your healthcare costs like triple. That's because the company is no longer paying for those, that portion of your healthcare benefits. So the company that you're working for is paying a big portion of your healthcare costs. So they are financially incentivized to have healthier employees. So with wellness programs, essentially what they're doing is they're saying, hey, our healthcare expenses for our employees are jumping dramatically. They're increasing dramatically, right? We've had a lot of conversations about the healthcare costs increasing. Well, companies are feeling that as well. So what wellness programs are is essentially your company is paying you or financially incentivizing you to be healthier. So whether it's like wearing a Fitbit whether it's, you know, paying the cost for your gym membership, whatever they need to do to make their employees healthier, they're willing to do. And so if you bypass those wellness programs, you're essentially saying, no, I'm not going to take money for you to pay me to be healthier. Like, yeah. And so that's one of those things where I think people are missing the boat. For me personally, the wellness programs that we have at our company pay almost half the cost of my healthcare. So, you know, I gave the 70-30 example. I'm probably paying somewhere between 10 and 15% because of the wellness programs and how much they're incentivizing us to be healthier because they want to reduce those costs.
Dope. And the other thing that I've found out lately that's a perk and benefit, and some places may have this, some places don't, but I know the larger companies often have these portals where you can go and get, you know, products, services at a discount.
Yep.
And bruh.
Yep.
I had not really been taking advantage of this. And I was like, oh, you know, I was going to get this app, but it's like 15 a month. And someone's like, did you not know we could get that for 15 for the year? I'm like, what? Really?
Yep.
And there's all of these different things that are out there, whether it's even for Christmas shopping, memberships, doggy daycare, all of these things that I could have been saving money on that I just wasn't looking in the portal because the company may not necessarily promote it as aggressively. But there's stuff that's out there that like people just don't take advantage of, that like the companies set up deals with these other organizations to allow people to get stuff at a discount, and people just don't use it because they don't know about it.
So think about it this way, and people don't think about it unless it's their own company. So remember, I was giving the example of, you know, working at the mall or whatever, and you had your friend that worked at the mall and you're like, all right, hook me up with your discount, right? Well, when you're adulting, when you're working at companies, oftentimes their vendor relationships get those discounts as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're at, if you're at Apple, for example, and Apple has relationships with all the phone carriers, right? And so you could get discounts on your cell phone. They would give discounts to Apple employees for their cell phones, for the cell phone plan. So you might get, you know, 20, 30% off your cell phone bill.
Yeah.
And so, but these are things that are in the notes in that packet that's in the bottom of your drawer. And if you don't know that, you're paying 30% more for your cell phone bill than you needed to. So that's just a quick example of just, it's not just the company that you work for, but they also have discounts, likely have discounts from all of their vendors. And so if you don't take advantage of stuff, you're paying, you know, the retail price for stuff that you should be paying, you know, the wholesale price for.
There it is.
You know, I'm sitting over here tight, Arthur clenched fist, thinking about the portal that I haven't accessed in the Christmas shopping I've already done. Like, I'm going to work Monday upset. Like, I was walking through this over here in my head. I'm like, yeah, I already know I'm missing out on something. But speaking of things that we're missing out on, I know we're getting close to wrap up here, but I wanted to talk about, I don't have the exact number. I want to say it was something close to like $250,000 over the life of your career. But how can people protect themselves from these fees that eat into or completely negate some of their annual gains?
Clarify that for me. In terms of their investments, like what type of fees?
I would say more on the investment side, but I think now they're coming out with these horror stories because I think we're seeing the first round of the, I'm going to say close to near failure of the 401k, but people are starting to pull from their 401ks and they're seeing that, yeah, you were averaging 8% returns, maybe, but 4% of that was ate up by our investment fees. And by the way, with 2% inflation, by the way, your return was 2%. So, you know, how can us millennials learn from these mistakes?
Yeah. So I think again, this goes back to the idea that we aren't taught about our finance. So people will go out and shop and go to, you know, 15 different stores to save $20, but are less likely to, you know, figure out how much they're actually paying for what they're investing in their 401k, which cost them thousands of dollars. So one way to figure out how much you're paying, and this is sort of, it's a little bit hidden, so you have to dig in for it, but you want to know with your investments, like let's say you're invested in a mutual fund, you want to know what's called the expense ratio of that investment, of that mutual fund, for example. Mutual funds aren't free. Right. Or investments in general are not free, particularly for a mutual fund, which is a bundle of different investments. You're paying the with your investment are paying a portion of that to the person that is managing that fund. Mm. Right. And that is a percentage of your overall investment. And that's called the expense ratio. What happened and where you might be getting this from is that with a lot of mutual funds, the expense ratios were very high. So expense ratio for investments, I would say it needs to be at most, it needs to be under 1%. But with things like target date funds, for example, those should be an index funds. Those should be less than half a percent, 0.5%, right? So looking at those, and there are tools to be able to see, you know, for your overall, you know, like I think Future Advisor is one, or, you know, there's like these robo advisors now that can go in and for free, take a look at your investments and see how much you're paying in expenses annually. And so we talked about inflation, and inflation is like, you know, like 3%, averages about 3% per year. So like, let's say your investments, for example, grow at 8% from 1 year to the next. Well, you know, inflation ate around 2 or 3% of that. And then if you have the expense ratio, which again is the cost of your investment, if that's over 1%, then that's, you know, that could be another percent that's eating up. So all of a sudden you think that your investments grew at 8%, but really, you know, it's like 5.
Yeah.
And so these are things that we need to talk about and understand. And, you know, and if you're investing in your 401k, if you're, you know, investing in your 401k, you're putting hundreds, if not thousands of dollars each month and each year into this thing. And so that's eating away at it. That's a lot of money that it's eating away. So you need to understand how much this thing costs. You can't just throw money into something and then wonder later, like, well, tell me how much it costs. So that's something that we need to be more upfront about and understand. I recommend if you have your 401k with your employer, whoever's providing that 401k, find out what their phone number is and give them a call and say, hey, I'm looking at my 401k. I need you to explain to me what these investments are, how much they cost, what is the expense ratio, and what would be the best for me in terms of, you know, like they're incentivized to give their own answer, but like what is best for your situation? An idea is, like I said, target date funds are a fund, for example, that you can just set a set amount. So if you want to invest in a target date fund, it would be, for example, it would be a fund that is set up for your retirement. So it would have a date, a future date on there, that the date that you turn 65 is usually when you do it. So like, let's say it was like 2045. So it'd be like the 2045 target date fund. And so essentially what it is, it's like a big mutual fund that is changing over time to set you up to try to retire in 2045. And so that it's basically like an all-in-one type of investment that you can do. So that's something that you can consider as an idea, as like sort of a one-stop shop fund for your 401k investing. And if your company matches that, then you're already doubling your investment there.
You know, it's funny you say that. I'm thinking to myself a few years ago, 2045, I'd be like, man, that's so far away. But now at 34, I'm like, man, that's so close.
Yo, I just did that quick math. I was like, ooh, chest pain.
Like when he said 2045, I was like, man, it's right around the corner.
Yeah.
So
it happens real quick.
Tell the people, and I'm not gonna put you on the spot, but I would make a suggestion. If you wrote that post for having that conversation with an investor, I'd read the hell out of it.
I might even buy it.
I mean, like, if you walk through that conversation, like what we just did right there, I'd be all over it, and I think the people would greatly benefit. So, speaking of which, where can the people find you for information like this and much more?
Yeah,
social medias.
On social medias, you can find me at Money Speakeasy. That's MONEYSPEAKEASY, Money Speak Easy, uniformly on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And the website is themoneyspeakeasy.com.
Cool, man. Cool. So, hey, Wilson, it's been awesome having you on the podcast. So I knew when we had a conversation at FinCon that, you know, you were going to bring a lot of insight. You just seem to have so much knowledge as is. And I hope that the listeners were able to get that from listening to the show today. So if you're listening to the episode and you have questions, thoughts, topics, you can email us at info@paychecksandbalances.com. But yeah, Wilson, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Oh, thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun.
And folks, as always, don't forget to join our email list where we share top articles we read throughout the week, work and money tips, and much more. You can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
There it is. So again, thanks to a great guest. Thanks to everybody for listening. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.